In association with Newsarama, welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Sundress. Today, we speak with writer J.M. DeMatteis. J.M. is known for groundbreaking character studies in arcs like Spider-Man, Kraven's Last Hunt, and his memorable Joker story, Going Sane, in Batman Legends of the Dark Knight. Today, J.M. discusses his new IDW miniseries, The Life and Times of Savior 28, with artist Mike Cavallaro, a compelling portrait of a longtime patriotic superhero who questions his role of aggressor in the never-ending battle. His story begins in the late 1930s and progresses through the post-9/11 21st century. J.M. discusses the story at length, and we also get into a discussion about his role as editor-in-chief of Arden Entertainment, including the new Flash Gordon series. We also talk about his continuing collaborations with Keith Giffen on Heroes Squared for Boom Entertainment, the final arc of that story coming up, Love and Death, and, as announced, the upcoming Metal Men reboot, which will be in the back of Keith Giffen's own Doom Patrol series for DC. That and much more, including JM's animation work on Batman the Brave and Bold, and a new fantasy novel in the works. But right now, the conversation begins with JM describing the inspiration for this IDW miniseries, The Life and Times of Savior 28. I found it very interesting that part of the inspiration for the story came out of your Captain America run, and it was one of my favorite Captain America runs, where he and the Red Skull, part of the deal was that the Skull had even like set up a simulation where Cap saves Bucky and kind of cleared his mind of any, you know, possible past
conflicts. Right, kind of washed away his guilt by creating this alternate reality where he saved him, yeah.
And then to, you know, this final face-off, which was, is it Cap 300? Wasn't it around then?
You've got a good memory because that was a long time ago. Yeah, that was Captain America 300. We had this year-long storyline that I've been building and building and building.
Mm-hmm.
And what logically came about for me was, especially since it was this showdown with the Red Skull, who was this guy that he had been fighting for at that point, you know, 40 years,
mm-hmm.
that when the Skull finally died, and I think the way the story ran, and again, it's been a long time, everybody in his intimate circle had been threatened by this. They all almost died, you know. And so finally, after this, you know, this horrible final battle that they have, he kind of wakes up and says, you know, what's the point of this? I've been doing this for 40 years. I've been punching people's faces in. I've been dropping buildings on their heads. And am I a better person? Is the world a better place? Is this the way to live? And frankly, I thought with Captain America, if anyone would ask those questions, it would be him.
Sure.
And so I evolved this whole storyline where he would basically turn his back on violence and try to find another way to live. And which, you know, for now, whatever this was, 1983 or 1984, was a fairly radical idea, you know. And I'd worked out in my head all the big beats, and it all played out with him becoming a global peace activist, the government turning against him, and him ultimately getting assassinated by Jack Monroe, who was the Bucky of the 50s, who I guess was Nomad at that point. It was
uh-huh.
his partner, you know. So it was this whole big, you know, political, global epic. And Mark Gruenwald, who was my editor at the time, was more than willing to take a chance on it. And Jim Shooter got one look at this and went, no, we can't do that. And at the time, it was like, what do you mean? And, you know, I was all upset about the whole thing. But, you know, in retrospect, I look back on it and I say, well, you know, you're doing a story with one of your major characters that basically questions the reason for being for your entire universe.
Absolutely.
Because if one guy says, this is a really stupid way to live, you're invalidating your entire universe as characters that jump around with capes and tights and spend a good part of their time punching people in the face, you know? So I can understand in retrospect as custodian of that universe why Jim would have said, no, we can't do this. But, you know, at the time, of course, I was all bruised and wounded over it and quit the book in a huff and all that. And now it's like, who cares? You know?
Well, and it's interesting, too, because that's kind of the point of Civil War in terms of, you know, well, and it wasn't in terms of just this the point of violence itself, but really someone like Cap standing up and saying, hey, you know, we're doing this wrong, or at least the government is wrong. And actually, that's not your point is different. It really is gets to the just essence of that violence. It can't be the solution to all of this.
Yeah, you know, I've said this to people at various points. You know, a lot of my stories have had spiritual themes in them. And especially my more personal work and the stuff, you know, whether I did for Vertigo or Epic or whatever else.
Mm-hmm.
And then periodically you'll get letters from people like, you know, how dare you preach spirituality? And I'm not trying to preach. I'm just writing a story about whatever it is I'm passionate about. But when you get into the realm of spirituality, people think you're preaching.
Sure.
Now, so I've been doing, you know, superhero comics for, 25 years. I've never once gotten a letter saying, how dare you preach violence? And yet, on some level, every superhero comic, which comes down to, at some point, two guys in costumes beating the living crap out of each other, is preaching a mindset that says, ultimately, violence is the best solution. And, you know, we layer it over with philosophy and characterization and all this stuff, but at the core of it, that idea is repeated and repeated and repeated and has been being repeated, you know, within the comic book genre, you know, since the 30s, and within adventure stories and that, you know, from the old myths, you know, from the dawn of time.
Sure.
And how come we don't question that? You know, go to the movies, go watch, you know, the big action movies. And what does it all come down to? The resolution always has to do with something blowing up and the bad guy getting a bullet through his head or thrown out a window or whatever it is. And, you know, that when you think about it, really, that's insane. That's not the way any of us want to live.
You know? Right. Well, and
so
it's
the
also
idea of having one of these characters say, you know what, there's got to be another way, and actually following one of these guys who's been doing, and my character, Savory 28 in the series has been around also, you know, since like 38, 39. Mm-hmm. So he's been at it and at it and at it and reaches this crisis point in his life where several things happen, and including, you know, the death of his old girlfriend, the death of his old adversary, and 9/11, all within days of each other. And he misses 9/11 completely because he's been off on a drunken bender. He's been laying in some motel room somewhere. So essentially he slept through this, you know, one of the greatest tragedies in our nation's history, you know. And wakes up, and there's another key piece that happens, and he realizes, I can't do this anymore. But the next part of the story is, okay, it's one thing to say I'm not going to do it anymore, but how do you live that?
Yep.
You know, and when does it stop just being words? And I didn't realize until I started writing the story that when he first starts doing this, as much as he's talking and making the flowery speeches about it, he has no clue what the hell he's doing. You know? And he's sort of play-acting it. It takes a while within the context of the story for him to wake up and realize that this is something that he really means, and he's gonna give his entire life to it. And of course he does, because our, unlike the Cap story, which ended with the assassination, our story begins with the assassination and kind of plays out in a, especially the first couple of issues, in a very sort of Citizen Kane flashback structure, constantly jumping through his life to try to understand who he was and what brought him to this point.
His sidekick, the daring disciple,
right,
is the narrator of the story, and yeah, kind of does take us through the Savior's life, Savior 28's life. And I like how not only does his life mirror real historical events like 9/11, like World War II, and I'm looking forward to more. And you've allowed me to preview the first two issues, but I also find it interesting that the various moments in comic book history are reflected as well through characterization and events that I think any fan of comics in the various decades that comics have gone through will recognize characters and even just basic story ideas that were being explored back then.
Right, exactly. That's the fun side of this, is that it's sort of a tour through pop culture and comic book history. It's a tour through sort of our political history. So it has all the, it really, you know, like I said, it could have been a 12-issue series, or, you know, it could have been a 2-year series, because there's so much I would love to put in there. And you know, maybe if this does well, we can go back and revisit their various points in this character's history. Because I just, when I was working on the third issue recently, and I had worked out this whole sequence about the Blacklist in the 50s relating to one of the characters, and, you know, spent a lot of time, you know, crafting this sequence, and realized there's no room for this, you know.
Wow.
Cut it out, tucked it away in a file, and hopefully, you know, I realized I could do an entire story about that. You know, you could devote 22 issues to that. So it's such a rich backdrop, and it's so much fun to play with it, that I'm hoping that maybe down the line we can revisit this world.
And he's not only kind of molded in the form of a Captain America type of patriotic hero, but also certainly Superman as well. And I think his backstory and the characters that are in this story will reflect not only, you know, different points of say a patriotic hero of that time, but also just this, as you say, Savior 28. I mean, the name says it itself. It is that kind of Superman, one hero,
right,
the greatest of the heroes, the first of the heroes. That,
yeah, Mike Cavallaro, our artist, had a great line. He said, you know, he's not modeled on any one character. He's modeled on all of them, you know? And there's little bits and pieces of all of them. But the great fun of the story for me is, you know, once you start writing, you may have this sort of archetype in mind, but when you write, you have to write a person. And so for me, once I started working, yes, there's all these elements of all these other characters, but he's a very specific person and personality. He's not just a cipher that we're trying to pour these ideas through. He becomes a very much of a three-dimensional person who's very, very specific and a very interesting guy. I tend to, as I write, to really fall in love with these characters as individuals and as real people, you know, and I've really connected with him as a human being.
Well, and he seems to start off as a very, yeah, I hate to use just conservative and liberal, because as you say, there's a much more nuanced character there, but yeah, that he kind of buys into, I think, what everybody bought into in the period leading up to World War II, or the majority of people, that, you know, we have to vanquish the bad guys, and that it was a very clear black and white, good versus evil kind of battle. And his girlfriend is an interesting counterbalance that, you know, rejects that. And you go back to that period before World War II and the isolationists and some of the people that were, you know, didn't want to get involved for other reasons, but there was also a very strong peace movement right before World War II as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, well, the thing that goes on with the girlfriend is interesting, because it's another one of the themes of the story, because being a superhero, if you're someone who's going to put on spandex and fly around, you know, you're into the big gesture, you know.
Yes.
You're definitely into doing it. You're into doing it on a big scale. And her advice to him constantly is, you know, it doesn't have to be the big gesture. You know, the old cliche, which is a cliche because it's true, you know, you change one heart and you change the world. It's, you know, the universe is found, you know, what did Blake say, a universe in a grain of sand, you know? The universe is found in the small gestures, too. One act of compassion is just as important as you flying around, you know, punching the bad guy in the nose, and probably more important. And he doesn't get it. He just doesn't. And even once he finally decides he's going to go out there and do the peace activist thing, and there's a big thing that happens in the third issue where his girlfriend, who by now is an old woman, has passed away, but he still has a connection with her daughter, and he goes to talk to her, and they have the same conversation again. You know, my mother would say, is you don't really have to do this. Well, what does he do? He goes off on a world peace tour. He's got to do it the big way. So there's always this sort of fight in him. You know, even when he's trying not to be a superhero, he's still doing it like a superhero. He's still doing it in the spotlight and in the spandex, and that's one of the big themes of the story, is how do we affect the world? Does it have to be with these big gestures, or is the microcosm the macrocosm? Is the smallest act of compassion as revolutionary as you know, as anything that, say, the President of the United States could do? So that runs through right to the end of the story.
His sidekick as well, the narrator of the story, has an interesting journey, and you can't help but compare what Ed Brubaker is doing right now in Captain America, with Bucky taking over the mantle, because your sidekick at a different time is called upon to take on the role as well. So this is a narrator that has been in his hero's shoes. And I like it. I mean, you kind of say it in the first issue that he was his greatest hero and his greatest enemy as well. And I'm sure this is explored throughout the book in terms of, you know, some of the frustrations and both the reasons why he loved the guy and the reasons why he couldn't stand the guy.
Yeah, that's one of the fun things also for me, is always finding the narrative voice, you know. I really, really like to find a specific narrator to filter the story through. And then, of course, once you do, so it's through his former sidekick, who now, although he has aged a little bit slower than the normal man, is still an older guy. I see him as sort of like, you know, James Cagney, when James Cagney was like in his late 50s, early 60s.
Okay.
You know? And you're getting the whole story filtered through his point of view. So as soon as you have a narrator, you don't know how true anything is, really. All you know is you're getting their truth. And so here's a guy who is completely ambivalent about him, about Savior 28. He loves him completely, and he loathes him completely, and every reaction in between, and it all plays into his filter and his focus on the story. And for me, that's been a lot of fun. Once I found his voice, it was really easy to get this story rolling. But for me, that's one of the hardest parts, is, you know, all right, what's the narrative point of view I'm going to pick for this story? And then if it's going to be a specific narrator, who is it going to be? And once I found him, it really unlocked a big key to the story, and it's been a lot of fun, because you become that person and you start to see the world through their point of view.
The first issue is already on the newsstands, and I do encourage people to pick it up, because it is...
Oh, there's an old word, newsstands, huh?
Well, yeah, I guess it's in the spinner racks. You're right. All right, at your local comic book shop.
Yeah, we're back in the 30s again here.
I think it's neat, because... it's a good first issue in that I think it sets up a lot. It has you asking questions by the end of it, but it's also a good, satisfying first read as well, because it not only informs the characters, but you do have some great scenes that kind of explain where this guy, you know, this hero's last journey and you know, yeah, where he's coming from and how, you know, again, as you say, the story begins with his death, and we are left with enough questions to want to follow this mystery and see why. And it continues in the second issue as well, because he has some specific reactions to events in World War II that, you know, even as early as that, he starts questioning his role or shuts down.
Right,
and I think that that's a really interesting reaction. I mean, you know, something that maybe Captain America was spared by being, you know, frozen in the block of ice retroactively by Stan Lee, in terms of, you know, you almost wonder. I don't even know if that was ever explored, some of the really dark chapters of World War II. I don't want to spoil the story, but if you know World War II, you probably know what I'm talking about. And, you know, we never really see that reaction from Cap, so it's kind of cool to see Savior 28 really respond to, again, some of the darker moments of World
War
II. Right,
you know, it's one thing to be, you know, jumping around, punching, you know, whatever, you know, the Nazi supervillain of the week, you know,
yeah,
who showed up to sabotage the factory, you know. And
absolutely.
But to be face-to-face, not as a hero, but as a man with the absolute horrors of that war and what happens to him, without giving too much away, that he does. You said it exactly right. He shuts down. He's not evolved enough at that point to really question anything. So he just kind of shuts down. And that's a very important piece of his journey, and it ties in really to what happens to him in the first issue with 9/11. Those two tragedies sort of echo each other through the story, and that, of course, is when the sidekick steps in to take over the identity, because President Truman asks him to step in and take over the job.
And there's an interesting, you know, point too, because You say it in that first issue, I think, where it's easy to make the past look much more innocent and much more pure and good, but because on the one hand, the government does take care of Savior 28 when he shuts down. But then, and we don't know, you know, it will follow in the issues to come, I guess, but what does happen when the government's best hero decides to stop being, you know, or best soldier, you know, decides to stop fighting? How do they react?
That's a very important piece of the story.
Yeah, and I think that's going to be neat. And that's, again, not only the dark points of World War II, but really all of these points of history. I just think, especially now, it's so much fun to see writers like yourself and a lot of the other, you know, A-list writers out there address these points of history, because it was things that were never even considered, I think, back in the 40s and 50s and 60s, maybe starting in the 60s, some people started writing about that. But I just think there is that history itself is such a fertile ground to put the superhero in and have him really address some of these bigger, truer issues than just, like you say, punching the face of of the bad guy. And really, is this the right move? And to explore their reactions to the real world. And it's, we've gotten little, you know, shades of that in some of the years in the last 20 or 25 years, but there's still lots of fertile ground to cover, and I'm glad to see you're doing that in this story.
Yeah, and you know, it's really a fine line, because if you really take it, which I'm sure, you know, writers have dealt with this too, if you take it all the way, didn't Roy Thomas write some story years ago where he had to explain why, you know, the Justice Society really didn't just fly to Europe and end the war in 30 seconds?
Yes.
You know what I mean? Because if you take it to its logical conclusion, that would have, you know, they would have ended it in 15 seconds. You know, it would have been over.
Well,
that would have been that. You know, so you have to sort of, you want to keep that historical reality, but if you push it too far, you have no story.
Yeah. Well, do you remember Siegel and Shuster even did that? How Superman would end the war?
No, I don't know. I didn't know that they did that.
Like, he grabs Stalin and he grabs Hitler and he sends them to the League of Nations. It was, you know, when it was still the European, or I guess it must have, it was before World War II started. Before the U.S. got in the war. Yeah, and it's literally this two-page story of him grabbing them and putting them before the League of Nations, which apparently still existed in the story. And, you know, yeah, it was done.
Over.
Exactly. You know, literally like 16 panels and we're done.
Right, right. Or as if it would really be that simple to untangle from all that, too. So, that, you know, and that's to go back to what you said before, this idea that, you know, we look back and the narrator says this, you know, oh, it was such an innocent time. But if you were living then, You know, I'm sure it wasn't an innocent time, talking to my parents or whatever. You know, it wasn't an innocent time. It was just life, just the way it is now, with all the shades of gray. But we put this filter on the past, and we so desperately want the past to have been more innocent. You know, it's like watching those old, you know, Twilight Zones or reading those old Ray Bradbury stories, you know, where someone wants to go back to the 1800s because that was the time of purity and innocence. But really, you know, maybe if you were a white male, it was.
Exactly, yeah.
But if you were anyone else, you were screwed. You know, it was not a time of innocence and purity and wonderfulness, you know?
Very true, and
so
very
cool. So we put these filters on the past and try to make it into something that it's not. Maybe, who knows, 100 years from now, someone could be looking back and come up with some reason why this was the innocent past, you know?
Well, how did you find Mike, your artist? And give
Mike, it was I met somebody at Book Expo America when we were doing the Abadazad books, and I was sitting at a table with a bunch of people from Hyperion Books for children at this dinner that they had, and this woman turned to me and said, "Oh, I have a friend that does comic books." And you know, sometimes when you hear that line in the back here, you're going, "Oh no," you know what I mean? Because people sometimes pull out the weirdest stuff, you know. And oh, he's publishing his own comic, and so I have two parts of my brain: the part of me that's always really excited to find new talent and see new people, and the other part that's afraid that they're going to send me some little stapled together thing, you know.
Sure.
But the part of me that really wants to encounter new talent is much stronger than the other voice. You know? So I was like, yeah, sure, have him send me his stuff. You know? And Mike was doing this comic called 66,000 Miles Per Second, I think was the name of it. And I get this package, and I open it up, and I read through the stuff, and it was just great. The art, I fell in love with the art instantly, and he's also a wonderful writer, and it's just, I was completely engaged and completely delighted, and I, you know, sent him an email, and we basically became friends through that. And you know, he's been keeping me up on what he's working on, and then he did a little bit when Giffen and I were doing the Planetary Brigade at Boom. He did a little five-page sequence for us on that, which was just brilliant.
Very cool.
And you know, this story clearly, I've been like playing with it literally for 25 years. You know, and there've been several times over the course of the 25 years where I've reworked it, and I said, now it's ready, and I pitch it somewhere, and they go, nah. And so I put it away for a few more years, and I take it out, and I rework it some more to reflect whatever political reality we're living in now, and then I pitch it, and it's like, nah, you know.
Okay.
So one day Mike sent me some samples for, he's part of an incredible collective of guys that do webcomics called Activate.
Oh, sure.
Dean Haspiel and a whole bunch of really, really hugely talented guys.
Absolutely.
Unbelievable group of talent there. And he was, Mike was, had done Parade with Fireworks, which was originally done as a webcomic. Then Image put it out, was nominated for an Eisner.
Very cool.
And then he spent a weekend reading old Kirby Thors and got inspired to want to do something that would reflect that sort of Kirby energy. And he started working on this webcomic called Leviathan. And he sent me the first batch of pages from Leviathan, and I looked at it and I went, oh my God, this is the guy that needs to be doing this story, you know?
Very
it was
cool.
Almost as if the story had been waiting 25 years for Mike to show up, you know? And so we took his samples and my proposal, and I've been talking to IDW about something else, sent it off to Chris Ryle at IDW, and I have never had this happen. The same day that I sent it to them, they got back to me by the end of the day and said, we'll do this.
That's awesome.
So, you know, it took a quarter of a century for an instant approval, you know.
Well, and I like what you say about Mike being inspired by Kirby, because I think, and from an energy standpoint, I feel that kind of energetic storytelling.
There's
that Kirby
a lot
has.
Of energy in Mike's work.
Yeah.
A lot of, it has a great fluidity and flow and energy. Yeah.
And
yeah.
And it's also kind of that cartoony, much like a Irwin Hasen and some of the guys from the Golden Age, and I think it works on that standpoint. But then you shift to, in the second issue, an early Marvel Age kind of moment, or maybe mid-60s moment of the Marvel Age, and his art fits there. So his art really, and in addition to the modern day, so I think his art can kind of speak well to the various decades that you're looking at.
And
as
yet
well.
He keeps his, he's able to reflect all those things and keep his own voice. His
Absolutely.
Own artistic voice. You know, also in the second issue, as you saw, there's the World War II sequence, which is hyper-realistic. And yet, you know, it almost has, the way he did it, almost has a sort of Eisenery flavor to it. And, you know, and there was nothing, you know, there's nothing over the top, there's nothing comic booky or superhero-y about that sequence there. And it's done in black and white, and it's just, it's pretty devastating.
Yeah.
Devastating. And brilliantly done. So it's just been great working with him, just great. Because, you know, what you want in a collaborator is someone who's, who clearly is talented and enthusiastic about the work, and then if they also happen to be an incredibly nice person and a total professional, which Mike is, then what else can you ask for, you know?
Is he an East Coast guy? Is he?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. Do you guys live close enough that you're able to get together and talk? Or
you know, we're a couple of hours apart.
Oh, okay.
But he's in the city, and I'm tucked away upstate. But but we just saw each other at the New York Comic Con, and you know, we're pretty much in touch almost every day with the project. You know?
Yeah, I'm sorry I missed you out there, man, because I was there running around doing video interviews, and I really meant to look for you, and I'm sorry that I didn't find you. Because
it's okay, we found each other now.
And it's a beautiful thing.
Right. I'm gonna cry. Hold on.
No, because also I wanted to talk to you as well about, you know, you're editing Flash Gordon right now,
or
the imprint that's doing Flash Gordon, and
Arden Entertainment. Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Arden Entertainment.
Thank you. And I think that's really cool, and I wanted to talk about that as well. And I don't want to slight Savior 28 though. Is there anything?
I'll talk about whatever you want to talk about.
Okay. Well, first of all, Savior 28, is it a 6-issue miniseries or?
That's what we're aiming for. Yeah.
Okay. Very cool. And as I say, issue 1 is out at your local comic book store, not the newsstands. I don't know what kind of penetration.
What they're doing, I believe, is it's a monthly, but the first issue they want to keep it out for 2 months because they want to just give people time to find it.
Okay, very cool.
And then it will be monthly after that.
Okay, so if your store doesn't have it, really go out and order this book. It's the full title again.
The Life and Times of Savior 28.
Thank you very much. There we go. And, I really do encourage you to check this out because having read that first issue, I was excited. And then having read the second issue, I'm like, this is a very cool story. Now we shift gears and we'll talk a little bit about Flash Gordon. It's cool to see Flash back.
Yeah, we're back in the 30s again.
Well, that's okay. You know, and I know you're a fan of these old pulp stories as well. And I think they got the right guy to be involved with this because based on our past discussions and stuff.
Well,
I know.
The great thing with what Brendan Dineen, who was our co-publisher and the writer of the book, the great thing about what he's done is that he really has kept all the old elements. You know, if you want Mongo and Lion Men and Hawkmen and Princess Aura and Ming, you know, and all that, it's all in there. And yet it feels very fresh and contemporary, and yet it still it still plays out almost like one of those old 30s serials, and there's great cliffhangers, but there's also wonderful characterization, and Brendan has done a terrific job of it. So, you know, it's Flash Gordon at its best, I think. You know, it's really if you know Flash Gordon, there's not a lot to say about it other than this is really sort of a wonderful contemporary reimagining that's very, very true to the tradition, but keeps it fresh.
Yeah, and a successful reboot as opposed to, and I hate to pick on it, but that Sci-Fi Channel, it was just
I never saw it, but boy, everybody I talked to.
It's like, what were they doing?
Mentions that thing, so it must have been really awful.
It was so sad, because it was just like, oh, man, you know, if you really don't need a big budget to make this thing happen, and you guys are just making all the wrong decisions. And, yeah, it just, you know, I know people are fans of the 1980 movie, and I'm not, unfortunately. I guess there's some things about it that are kind of silly fun, and the Queen soundtrack's kind of okay, but I don't know, it's just...
I think it's a generational thing.
It must be, man.
I think it depends how old you were when that movie came out, because that movie doesn't mean anything to me. I grew up, you know, in New York, and on Sunday morning or Saturday morning, they used to play the old Buster Crab.
You bet, man. Serials. Absolutely. Me
and
too
to
in
me,
Chicago.
You know, that's Mongo. It's this Art Deco place with these cheesy little spaceships, you know.
Absolutely.
Which weren't cheesy when we were kids. You know, I was like, you know, this was like, you know, before Star Trek, before Star Wars, you know, I was like, you know, 8 years old watching this. It was the first big space opera I'd ever seen. One of the fun things we just did was first we did a limited edition for the New York Comic Con, a Flash Gordon anthology to celebrate the 70th anniversary of a character. So Brendan's written a story and I've written a story. We've got Len Wein, Joe Casey, Denny O'Neill. I'm blanking out. Jim Kruger.
Wow.
We got have art by Sean McManus and Paul Green and Joe Staten. And
oh, that's great.
And it's good. We're going to have, I guess, we'll be putting it out again for the general market in May.
Okay.
But it was really fun because I got to write a Ming story, you know. and the question I always like to ask anyone that's read my work knows is, okay, so why are you the tyrant who rules Mongo? You know, what happened to you when you were a kid? So it's really a story about, you know, when he was a kid living through the Civil War in Mongo and the events that happened that turned him and made him realize that he's got to be the guy to pull this planet together, you know?
That's
and
really cool.
Once you start writing a character, you go, oh, my God, what a great character. Ming is a great character. And Brendan has also done that with the regular series. He's not just a mustache-twirling villain. You can't get away with that anymore anyway, you know?
Absolutely.
There's a reason why this guy has got this iron grip on Mongo, because from his point of view, if he doesn't, that whole planet's going to go to hell in a handbasket.
Well, and the best villains are the ones where you can appreciate their motivations.
Exactly.
And if not sympathize, you understand where he's coming from. And again, going back to the Savior 28 story as well, you understand this villain's motivations and why the story has unfolded the way it did. And
right.
you do feel for this person in a much more realistic way. But again, back to Flash Gordon, much like a lot of the Golden Age characters that just now are getting re-explored, you know, those stories were written for 8-year-olds. Well, now it's fun to take those two-dimensional characters and add that third dimension of real characterization to them and give them reasons why they exist and why they are the way they are. And that's the fun thing to explore now as these characters are readdressed.
Right, because the basic underpinnings, you know, still work.
Yes.
A great space adventure is always a great space adventure, you know? But what we all demand as readers now and as viewers are characters that, just what you said, that have a little more dimension to them. And that's what Brendan has done. You know, Flash is a lot more interesting. Dale is like a million times more interesting, you know?
Very cool.
Ming is more, everybody is more interesting. And then to have these characters with all these shades of gray playing out against the good old-fashioned space wars that we all still enjoy, I think makes it a really great read. So I'm very, very happy with the way the book is turning out. And for me, this is one thing. I've done a lot of things in my years in comics, but editing is not one of them. So it's been fun to do that. But what I have done over the years is I'm often working with new writers. People will write to me and say, oh, you know, I want to do this, I want to do that. Can you help me out? Can you read my stuff? Can you send me feedback? And I've always enjoyed doing that. So to be able to do it in an official capacity now is really, really fun, to sit there and take someone like Brendan, who's relatively new to the writing end of it. He's worked in the movie business for years, and he was an executive at Miramax, and now he's a manager. But he's reasonably new to the writing end of things, and he's really talented. And to work with him every month and see him get even better every month, I just sat down and edited the first half of the most recent script, and I have seen the growth, you know, from the zero issue that we did a year ago to issue 5, which we're doing now, and it's terrific, you know.
Very cool.
And that's a lot of fun for me to be able to be involved creatively from that side of things. As any freelancers out there know, you know, I've spent, you know, 25, 30 years basically in a room by myself playing with my imaginary friends, you know. And it's great, and I wouldn't trade this lifestyle for anything, but it also gets a little isolating and lonely. And the great thing about the editing side of things is it opens the door on a little more active collaboration with a larger group of people. I'm collaborating with my artist, I'm talking to an editor, and that's about it, you know, in terms of the comic book side of things. But as the editor, there's much, much more give and take and flow and creative interplay going on. So it allows my creative life to open up and flow in a new direction. It's been fun.
Who have you talked to kind of, you know, sharpen whatever editing skills you need in terms of, like, you know, where did you go to say, okay, you know, how do I do this? Or did you need to go to anyone?
You know, at this point in the game, I've been doing this so long, I've sort of developed my own set of what I think is a good story and how do you tell a good story. And, you know, and if I go back anywhere, I go back to the editors, I guess, that I started with years and years ago. I mean, the first one that comes to mind is Len Wein, who was the first editor that I ever worked with. I'd been in the business for a little bit, but Len was the first guy that kind of took the light and put it in my face and said, you know what, you have talent and ability, and let's work to develop that, you know?
That's awesome.
And that, to me, is probably the most fun part, is just what I was saying, that ability to encourage somebody else creatively and say, guess what, you've got something there. Let's work to bring it out. Let's bring out the best in what you have and help you to grow and to express yourself, not to express my point of view through you, but let me help you to express what you have to say. I've seen a lot of editors over the years who what they really want to do is put their imprint on the book and on the writer, so that really what's coming through the pages is not the writer's point of view, but their point of view.
I understand, you know? Yeah.
And I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in a good story and sharing my knowledge of, you know, 30 years of writing experience, but I want the writer that I'm working with to be, you know, to be able to express themselves to the fullest, you know.
That's cool.
So that's a lot of fun, because it's not a lot of fun having an editor who basically wants to be a ventriloquist and write the book through you.
Sure. Know? No, I understand, and I think, you know, just in general, I think in comic history we've heard stories of editors that did do it that way, sometimes in the Silver Age and sometimes as recently as maybe 10 or 15 years ago, and
yes,
maybe even
indeed.
Currently. Yeah.
And we all know what we're talking about.
Exactly. Let's all wink together and know what we're talking about. But, no, you know, Len, I'm so happy for him. He's had a nice run of a few stories lately as well for DC.
He's gotten very busy at DC again, which is great.
Yeah.
It was so much fun for me. That's the other thing I've never gotten to do in this business is hire somebody else.
Yeah.
I'm always the guy tap dancing to get hired, you know? And so to hire Len, who was so important to my career, to have him come in and do this story, and he did such a great job, too. It was really delightful. It was really delightful.
Man, I'll be looking for that in May then, because that's really cool. What got me excited about Flash Gordon again, even before you guys came out with your book last year, was I found in one of the old bins at one of the stores a Mac Raboy series of the daily strips that he did that Dark Horse put out.
Oh, cool!
And yeah, I was just like, oh man, you know, you get so set on Alex Raymond and all the beautiful stuff that he did. And it's like, I never saw Mac Raboy's run on Flash Gordon. It's like, this stuff is fantastic.
Yeah. You know, there's so much out there and there's so much history that we're still learning about that we, you know, it's almost impossible to have read it all. You know?
Oh, sure.
I'm sure there's some nerd out there who's read it all, but, you know, the rest of us haven't.
Absolutely, man. Well, and I'm excited to see you and Keith and Kevin get back together again on The Metal Men, which will be the backup series in Doom Patrol, or I should say co-series, because... am I correct? Like, one is 12 pages and the other is 10 pages? Is that how it's working?
As far as I understand, and, you know, please let someone from D.C. correct me, I believe that what they're doing now is the lead story is going to be a full-length 22-page story.
Okay.
And then we're going to be 10 pages behind that.
Okay. Well, yeah.
Which is really kind of fun, you know?
Sure.
And,
well,
you know, Kevin likes to take his time, so 10 pages is perfect for a monthly thing for Kevin.
Okay.
You know, it takes a lot of time to draw all those expressions.
I understand.
And, you know, it's funny. It's just one of those things. Every once in a while, Keith will just call me up and say, I want to do this. And because it's Keith calling me up, I say, sure. I don't even really think about it. So he said, you want to do Metal Men? I said, sure. Not necessarily because I was, like, such a Metal Men fan. I mean, I remember reading Metal Men as a kid, but I wasn't, like, any big fan. But I knew that together and with Kevin, we could have a lot of fun with this. And I just recently scripted the first one, and it's just... we're having a ball already, you know?
That's great, man. Well, you know, Heroes Squared and Planetary Brigade for Boom, the Justice League miniseries that came back, and the Defenders thing, too, which was just hilarious. I mean, that's the thing. It's great to see that, you know, the Bwahaha team is still, you know, firing on all cylinders. And, I mean, that's the great thing. And I think the Metal Men is another great group of characters that, just because of the extremes of what characterization they have and stuff, that, yeah.
Oh, yeah, there's a great, well, I don't really realize it until I sit down very often to actually do the writing, you know. You can conceptualize all you want before you start to write, but then especially when I'm working with Keith, because what Keith does is he puts down this rock-solid foundation for the story. You know, you get the basics of the plot, you get the basics of the characterization, you get a few great one-liners in there, and the rest is for me to just, you know, fill the pages with as many balloons as I possibly can.
Okay.
And if you read Hero Squared, you know that we can fill it with a lot of balloons.
Absolutely.
Know? And so I started to write these characters and understand, you know, through the dialogue who they were, and I suddenly saw all the potential to really play with these guys. And it's really, I think we're going to have a lot of fun, a lot of fun. But you mentioned Hero Squared, and if I'm going to be plugging things, we have a Hero Squared miniseries out right now.
Love and Death.
Love and Death. Oh, you're on top of everything, aren't you?
Well, we try.
Yeah,
we try. But tell us about Love and Death. Yeah,
it is the absolute final Hero Squared story. Actually, when we get this story done, if we hopefully in a year or so collect it all together in one big omnibus, you will have a really, really good story with a beginning, a middle, and an actual ending to it. You know,
that's really cool. You know, I wanted to ask, and I wasn't sure if I saw Ross Ritchie's presentation at WonderCon,
and
he said he referred to it as the last Hero Squared story. And I'm like, oh, is that a editorial edict or, you know, publishing edict, or is that you guys? You know,
it was a couple of things. I mean, you know, mainly it was, if you follow the arc of what the story is doing. You know, it's funny, in a lot of ways, Hero Squared and Savior 28 kind of dovetail, because when we the premise of Hero Squared being that we have a hero from a comic book universe dropping into the real world, and then we begin to question how does that model work in the real world? It's a lot of the same themes that will crop up in Savior 28. We play it a lot more lightly and for laughs in Hero Squared, although there's a lot of serious stuff in there too. But you know, when we started working on Hero Squared, it was one of the things I pushed for. Is I said, you know, we have to really, really deal with the real world consequences if one of these guys really existed. And a lot of that was in my head because of this idea for Savior 28 that I had for years. And so as we began to deal with that and progress the characters through these various stories, you know, we started with a one shot, then a miniseries, yep. and a six issue series, and now another miniseries. So as the characters evolved, we saw that we have to bring them to an end point. It's not the kind of thing where we could just do it like a TV sitcom and have the same situation continue to exist week after week. The characters had to move along and really grow and really change. So that by the end of this story, Captain Valor has reached a point where there's no coming back from. Milo has reached a point where he's completely changed. All the characters have really completely evolved to the other end of the scale. And I think it's I think it is a very satisfying ending that really, really does end the story, completely ends it. You put a button on it, and it's done, you know?
That's really cool.
Yeah. So I'm actually very excited about it. And unfortunately, Joe Abraham was not available to do this. And we got a wonderful artist named Nate Watson who's doing just a really terrific job. And he's evoking Joe just enough not to make it jarring for readers that are used to Joe's stuff.
Okay.
And yet he's bringing his own voice to it, too, which is all you could ask for. It's a really tough comic to draw because it depends so much on the same sort of dialogue and banter that, you know, Keith and I are known for. My favorite issue of Hero Squared was one we did a year or two ago, which was just Milo and Valor in the therapist's office for 22 pages. You know, it's not easy to draw that and sell that without it looking static, and Joe Abraham is the master of that. We have in this final miniseries, we get Milo, Valor, Caligonus, and Steffi all back in the. So we've got four people in the therapist's office carrying on.
Wow.
You know? and I have to say, Nate did a terrific job. Terrific job. So, but then turns around and we have to have all the superhero action too.
Sure.
So we need that ability to really sell both of those things, and Nate really, really did a great job.
That's cool. And as you say, Joe was always capable of doing that as well. And that's what I liked about the book. At times, it was very much another funny, independent, you know, humor book that I think a lot of the independent fans would really get into. And anybody that's a superhero fan that doesn't need it always to be The Perils of Pauline and Saving the Girl off the Railroad Tracks can appreciate looking at superheroes from a personal and humorous standpoint. I think they would find Hero Squared a great read. And I know that the trades are out there of the previous arcs, and I look forward to the omnibus as well.
I would love to see it all. All collected together a little ways down the line, because it really will make a terrific story.
Very cool, man. That's really great. Do you have G.I. Joe stuff coming up?
I saw that online. Someone made a really big mistake.
Okay, fine, because I thought I saw your name with G.I. Joe, and I'm like, oh, I should probably ask him
I think they took the IDW info and they mixed it up, and suddenly there's a G.I. Joe issue written by me and drawn by Mike Cavallaro, you know? Someone else must have, you know, somebody else's name writing and drawing Savior 28 at the moment, too, you know? So I don't know what the hell happened with that one. I just happened to notice that today. But, G.I. Joe, what? Oh, no, it was Transformers. That's what it was.
Oh, okay. Yeah, all right. Well, then that's fine. Then we've cleared up the mistake. That's good.
No, I'm busy with a bunch of stuff. I'm actually writing a book. I'm writing a young adult fantasy novel for HarperCollins that will be out next year.
Very cool.
Called Imaginalis.
Wow.
I guess if those that love Dabadazad, I think, will enjoy this book very much.
You know, and will you tell people, in as best as you can, what happened? Because I saw Alex Siegel at WonderCon, and we were talking, and he mentioned John Muth, and I'm like, oh, you know, I'm supposed to be talking to Mark soon, and he brought up Dabadazad, and unfortunately that the story wasn't going to continue. I'm really sorry that didn't happen, man.
But, you know, here's another one of those strange things, you know. Dabadazad had a life of its own to begin with. You know, it took me years to sell it. Then we sold it to CrossGen, and
yes.
CrossGen went down. And then we had a Sue CrossGen. And then Disney came in and they put out these books. And then all this melodrama happened. We got three books out, and then they canceled that thing. So when we finally got the word from Hyperion that the book series had been canceled, I did a very Victorian thing. I don't know if you remember the Victorian novels. They'd say that they took to their beds, you know. And I got so depressed, I just sort of laid in bed for a day. You know?
Okay.
You know, I didn't swoon or anything, but I did lay in bed depressed for a day.
Sure.
And the thing that really bothered me more than anything was not the fact that, A, I was losing a year's worth of income because we had signed for like 8 books, you know.
Okay.
But the thing that really bothered me was that I lost these characters. I'm in the middle of this story, and these characters that I'd become so invested in and that I loved so much and that were so real to me were sort of trapped in limbo. So I'm laying in bed, and suddenly I'm thinking, trapped in limbo, character, what a great story. And I got out of bed, and I ran into my office, and I wrote up this, like, you know, 6-page outline of this story. And then Brenda Bowen, who was the woman at Hyperion who had brought Bodazot over there, left Hyperion and went over to HarperCollins and started her own imprint there, the Bowen Press.
Okay.
And I ended up pitching her that idea, and that's the book that I'm doing.
Oh, that's great.
So out of the ashes of defeat, you know.
Very good.
My line is, creativity is the best revenge. You know, out here in the freelance trenches, there's always the next idea. And no matter what happens to knock you down, you always get back up again. And there's always the next idea. And I, you know, you can't stop it. Once you've been doing this for a while, I can't stop ideas from coming. They just keep coming, you know?
That's cool.
Sometimes I would like them to stop. But it's like, oh, I have to write that down. Let me. And sometimes, like with Savory 28, it may take 25 years to sell. And sometimes with this other idea, it could take, you know, no time to sell it. But it's a funny life that we choose for ourselves out here in the freelance trenches, you know? But I wouldn't trade it for anything.
So
I'm working on the book, and I've been doing some animation work for Batman Brave and the Bold, which has been a lot of fun.
Yes, tell me about that. Which episodes have you written?
A couple of them have been on already. One which was Batman and the Green Lantern Corps against Despero, which had Nort in it and Guy Gardner.
Outstanding.
It was a lot of fun. And the first one I did was a Batman and Green Arrow. Then I have a Batman Red Tornado coming up, and I recently wrote it was Batman, Blue Beetle, and the Green Lantern Corps. So, and I think they told me I'm going to have another one to write shortly. So that's been a lot of fun.
That's great. You know, that show has really recaptured the energy, I think, of the Fox show and of the Justice League iterations. And now, because I got to be honest, I wasn't a big fan of that second Batman series that happened in the early 2000s with The Edge doing the theme music. And
that recent one. Yeah.
Yeah. And I just, for some reason, it just didn't have the fun. And, mm-hmm. and maybe also because it was maybe playing to a younger audience, I felt shut out being in my 40s. But this one I know plays well to a young audience, The Brave and Bold, and I know adults love it. And it is. It's just this fun, exciting kind of action show. I think it's terrific.
Yeah, no, it really and it does. It works on both those levels. And, you know, it's a great antidote to the Dark Knight movie.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's so at the other end of the spectrum, you know. The Dark Knight movie, I mean, had great stuff in it, but I have to say, I finished that movie and I said, I think it finally happened. Someone has taken comic books too seriously, you know.
No, I understand. I hear what you're saying. And, you know, it was funny because I would talk to non-comic book fans who truly loved it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, really? It didn't like, I mean, because I loved it too. I think it's a great movie, but I kind of had that same feeling of, I mean, it was great, and I wasn't bored, but I also was like, shouldn't this be ending soon? I mean, it just like felt like that third act was never going to end. And they put so much into it. And again, it was all good stuff, and I thought it was great, but I'm like, they could have made 2 movies out of what they covered in this movie.
Yeah, and it was so unrelentingly dark. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
You know, I don't mind dark when it leads you to the light, you know, anyway, I don't need to get into a critique of the Batman movies. It's certainly, most of the world would argue with me anyway, and was the movie made $1 billion?
Well, yeah, I mean, and again, I'm thrilled and I'm happy because I want more Batman movies. And
yeah, absolutely.
And I want, you know, I think Batman fans obviously want a more realistic movie rather than, unfortunately, what the Schumacher films kind of devolved into.
Right.
So, yeah, I would prefer to have that. Now, I got to ask what you thought of Watchmen, if you've seen it yet.
Haven't seen it yet. I have to say that the superhero movie that I loved this year was Iron Man.
Sure.
It was the first time I saw a superhero movie and said, I like that better than the comic.
Wow. I liked it a lot, too. I thought I think had there not been Dark Knight, certainly everyone would still be talking about Iron Man because it only made $600 million. Geez, sorry.
And it was really smart, and it had a great sense of humor, and it had a great heart, and Robert Downey was just like letter perfect, and it was really... you know, it suffers from the same problem that all this stuff suffers from. And in fact, I'll bring it all the way back to Savior 28. You know, the first scene of Savior 28 is this big battle between the hero and his archenemy, you know, where they're beating the living crap out of each other, which is the third act of every superhero movie.
Of course.
You can't get around it, no matter how smart and how clever. By the third act, it's two guys picking up cars and hitting each other over the head.
That's true.
You know, and here was this really, really smart movie, and I thought that the only weak part was that, you know, they couldn't get around it. You had two guys in metal suits beating each other up, and it was sort of a letdown. But the rest of it was so smart.
And I thought Jeff Bridges. Thank you. I'm blanking. He was just first unrecognizable in a good way.
Yeah.
I mean, just when he came out with that egghead, you know, and that Grizzly Adams kind of, you know, beard, I'm like, who the hell is that?
Yeah.
And I thought it was fantastic. He was an excellent Stain, but you're right. At the end, he devolved into, you know, it was two guys in robot suits just beating the crap out of each other.
And that you know, to me, that's one of the things that also motivated me a lot with the Save 28 story, because when you translate these stories to live action, you know, if you're watching it in a cartoon, and someone goes through a building and falls down, and then someone picks up a car and hits someone else on the head, or on the page of a comic book, there's a level where you can buy into that reality in a certain way, and it's okay. You know? But the minute it's real, living, three-dimensional people on screen, and I always go back to, let's go back to Batman again. In the first Batman movie, there were two scenes that just, you know, drive me crazy. One is, you know, Batman's trying to save the girl, and the police are chasing him, and he's driving through Gotham, and he's, like, knocking police cars left and right, and they're flipping over, and you know there's, like, dead policemen all over Gotham.
Yeah.
You can get away with that on the page of a comic book and think, okay, they're okay. Or Stan used to always have people fighting in abandoned buildings. That was always a sign, you know, abandoned building. And the other is a scene that I actually sort of did a twist on in Savior 28 number 2, where Batman's there with the Liam Neeson and the League of whatever they were, the Ra's al Ghul group.
Yes.
And they're in the headquarters, and they want him to kill this guy to prove that he's worthy of joining them, because this guy is a loathsome criminal and he must die. And Batman says to him, you know, oh, no, I won't do that, because the difference between us is I have compassion. And then after he makes his speech about compassion, he goes, sets about blowing up the entire place. Killing just about everybody in it, you know, except for Liam Neeson, who's the bad guy, including the guy that he just refused to kill. You know, he went up in a ball of flame.
Yeah, that's okay.
And you know, and that's to me, you know, the absurdity of these stories too, because Stan was so great at that. You know, Kirby would draw this amazing stuff, and these guys would be bashing each other with cars and throwing each other through walls, and then Stan would have them having a philosophical discussion, you know, while they were having it, which would sort of take your attention away from the violence, you know. But the minute you put it on screen like that, and you hear these speeches about compassion followed by somebody blowing up the, you know, the bad guy's headquarters, you know, the contradiction, the absurdity, and really the harmfulness of the idea really comes out. So I did a scene, as you read in the second issue of Savior 28, which is very, very similar, where he gives a speech about compassion before completely blowing up the bad guy's headquarters. Yeah.
No, it's a great scene, and I'm glad you brought that up, because you're right, it is. It's that collateral damage that is never accounted for.
Never,
And is in your story, and I think that's what makes this, again, part of what makes it an interesting story, and definitely worth picking up. So look forward from IDW and enjoy it, and also looking forward to The Metal Men, that'll be backing up Doom Patrol as well. I think that's really cool. And the final chapter in the Hero Squared saga, Love and Death, which is already on sale.
And lots of good things coming from Arden in the next year. We have the three new series that we're going to be rolling out. And so a lot of good stuff.
Okay. Not ready to announce the properties yet, as far as that goes?
Oh, yeah. You know, we can talk about them very briefly. One is something that I'm co-writing with a friend of mine named Derek Webster called The Merlin Prophecies, which is a very a contemporary spin on the old Arthurian legend. It's a very modern New York take on it. There's no dragons or magic swords or wizard hats or anything, you know. It's more sort of like X-Files meets Merlin.
Okay.
And we just did a zero issue for the New York Comic Con, but the series probably won't roll out till the end of the summer. Jim Kruger and Alex Cal are doing this great book called The Stand-In. We just did a zero issue of that as well, which I'm really excited about. Kruger's a really terrific writer, and he's got a great story there.
Excellent.
And then there's another one which is still in the very early stages, which we also did a miniseries on, called Deathshade. So I'm blanking. I almost forgot the name. Forgive me. And that, too, is sort of a spin on what we think is sort of the typical, you know, dark Avenger-type character, but it has a lot more meat on the bones than that. So what we're trying to do with Arden is really take it slow. And first of all, look at the market. You know, you've got to be crazy to want to go out and throw a lot of titles out there.
I understand.
B, we're not trying to compete with Marvel or DC or Dark Horse or anybody. We're just trying to keep it small and do some books that we're happy with and proud of, you know.
Very cool. Well, you know, I think Flash Gordon is a good first step for Arden, and I wish you guys luck with the new stuff as well. You got talented people working with you, including yourself, so that's cool.
Yeah, I got to hire me.
Yeah. Well, they hired you, so that's good.
I got to hire me for Merlin, though, you know.
All right, very cool.
I have to give me a raise now.
Excellent, man. Well, see what you can do about that. But no, man, hey, that's awesome, and really, the Savior 28 story is really, really cool, and congratulations. I think it's a great start. And look forward to its wrap up and again, yeah, looking forward to wrapping up here at Square and seeing what's happening with the Metalmen as well. So I appreciate your time, Mark. It's always good to talk to you.
It's great to talk to you too, John.
And happy that everything is going well. So really, when you're ready to talk about more new stuff, please give me a call back.
Yeah, and when this book comes out next year, we'll flog that one to death.
My pleasure, man.
All right, John. Thanks.
Nice conversation with J.M. DeMatteis. Make sure you check out The Life and Times of Savior 28, the new IDW miniseries. Also, it's already begun from Boom Studios, the last chapter of Hero Squared, Love and Death. And coming in just a few weeks, the new Doom Patrol and Metal Men series from DC Comics. Plus, from Arden Entertainment, the Flash Gordon series, their 70th anniversary anthology coming out in May. That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks again for listening. John Sutra saying thanks and reminding you that if you have any questions or comments about the show, come visit us at the Word Balloon Forum at wordballoon.com or follow me on Twitter, John Word Balloon, or you can reach me via email, john@wordballoon.com. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2009.